Hi, I'm Spider Robinson, and you found Spider on the Web number 32, a user-supported shenanigan being podcast, as always, under Creative Commons license, no derivatives, non-commercial, share alike. The Democratic presidential campaign is heating up. Bad vibes between the Clinton and Obama camps, temperatures fraying, improvident words being spoken. Time to remember why we're going through all this in the first place, what we ought to be concentrating on. And here to remind us is Todd Butler of Comox, B.C., with a track from his 2006 CD, Idle Canadian.
I'm Bush from getting dicked around.
Caller number four, you're on the air.
Hello? Hello? Am I on? Hello?
I've been terrorized, I've been hypnotized, I've been Osama.
Been Taliban, how much Michael Moore can I Afghanistan? Cause I'm Bush.
He's Bush.
For getting digged around. Getting paranoid, it's getting hard to sleep. Cause my best friend's a gun toting Jesus freak. And I'm Bush.
He's Bush.
For getting digged around. I've been out to lunch, they got sucker punched. I've been out stumped, the field Bible thumped. Got neocon and Halliburton. For all this, those insurgents weren't insurgent. Were they? Didn't they just live there? Till they got bushed.
That was Todd Butler on lead vocals and lead guitar. If you go to his website, www.toddbutler.com, you can hear other representative tracks from that CD, Idle Canadian. Even cooler, you can hear a couple of tracks from his latest album, Hamburger Soup, an all-instrumental album of guitar music, as he calls it, my midlife guitargasm. Check out those sample tracks, and by the way, don't miss the karaoke version of the song you just heard, Bushed, at YouTube. Now I'm going to read you one of my science fiction short stories. This reading is dedicated to all the brave men and women who at this time are over there in the desert bleeding and sweating because of Mr. Bush. This is a dream I had once, and it's a dream that I suspect a lot of them might share with me. You'll probably recognize the title as a truncated quotation from the philosopher Buddy Holly. From 1957. Not Fade Away. I became aware of him 5 parsecs away. He rode a nickel-iron asteroid of 100 metric tons as if it were an unruly steed, and he broke off chunks of it and hurled them at the stars, and he howled. I manifested at the outer periphery of his system and waited to be noticed. I'm sure he had been aware of me long before I detected him, but he affected not to see me for several days, until my light reached him. I studied him while I waited. There was something distinctly odd about his morphology. After a while I recognized it. He was wearing the prototype, the body our ancestors wore. I looked closer and realized that it was the only body he had ever worn. Oh, it had been balanced and space-proofed and the skull shielded, of course, but he looked as if when balancing was discovered he had been just barely young enough for the process to take. He must have been one of the oldest of the eldest. But why keep that ridiculous body configuration? It was hopelessly inefficient, suited only to existence on the surface of planets, and rather poorly to that. For a normal environment, everything about it was wrong. I saw that he had had the original sensory equipment improved for space conditions, but it was still limited and poorly placed. Everything about the body was laid out bilaterally and unidirectionally, creating a blindside. The engineering was all wrong, the forelimbs all severely limited in mobility. Many of the joints were essentially one-directional, simple hinges. Stranger still, the body was grotesquely, comically over-muscled. Whenever his back happened to be turned to his star, the 40-kilo bits of rock he hurled achieved system escape velocity. Yet he was able to keep that asteroid clamped between his great thighs. What individual ever, much less routinely, needs that much strength in free space? Oddest of all, of course, his mind was sealed. Apparently totally, I could get no reading at all from him, and I am a very good reader. He must have been completely unplugged from the bonding, and in all my 3,000 years I have met only 4 such. He must have been as lonely as any of our ancestors ever was. Yet he knew that the bonding exists, and refused it. A number of objects were tethered or strapped to his body, all worn but showing signs of superb maintenance. It took me several days to identify them all positively as utensils, several more to realize that each was a weapon. It takes time for things to percolate down out of the race memory, and the oldest things take the most time. By then he was ready to notice me. He focused one of his howls and directed it to me. He carefully ignored all the part of me that is bonded, addressing only my individual ego, with great force.
"Go away!"
"Why?" I asked reasonably.
"Go away at once, or I will end you!"
I radiated startled interest. "Really? Why would you do that?"
"Oh, ah!"
There was a silence of some hours. "I will go away," I said at last, "if you will tell me why you want me to do so." His volume was lower.
"Do you know who I am?"
I laughed. "How could I know? Your mind is sealed."
"I am the last warrior."
"Warrior? Wait now. Warrior. Must be an old word. Warrior. Oh. Oh! You kill and destroy. Deliberately. How odd. Are you going to destroy me?"
"I may,"
he said darkly. "I see. How might I dissuade you? I do not believe I am old enough to die competently yet, and I have at least one major obligation outstanding."
"Do you lack the courage to flee, or the wit?"
"I shall attempt to flee if I find it necessary, but I would not expect to succeed."
"Ah, you fear me."
"Fear? No, I recognize the menace you represent. I repeat, how might I dissuade you from ending me? Is there something I can offer you? Access to the bonding of minds, perhaps?" This reply was instant.
"If I suspect you of planning to initiate the bonding process with me, I will make your death a thing of unending and unspeakable agony."
I projected startlement, then masked it. "What can I do for you, then?" He laughed.
"That's easy. Find me a fair fight. Find me an enemy. If he or she or it is as strong as me, I will let you go unharmed. If stronger, I will give you all I own and consecrate my death to you."
"I am not sure I understand."
"I am the last warrior."
"Yes?"
"When I chose my profession, warriors were common and commonly admired. We killed or destroyed not for personal gain, but to protect a group of non-warriors, or to protect an idea or an ideal."
I emanated confusion. "Against what?" His answer was days in coming.
"Other warriors."
"How did the cycle get started?"
"Primitive men were all warriors."
"Really?"
"Then there came a time when the average man had to be forced to kill or destroy. One day he could no longer be forced. A balanced human in free space cannot be coerced, only slain. Can you visualize circumstances which would force you to kill?"
"Only with the greatest difficulty," I said. "But you enjoy it? You would find pleasure or value in killing me?" A week passed. At last he smote his asteroid with his fist, sharply enough to cause rock to fly from its other side.
No, I lied. I will not kill you. What good is a fight you can't lose?
Why did you lie?
In order to frighten you.
You failed.
Yes, I know.
Why did you wish to frighten me?
To compel you to my will.
I believe I see. Then you do wish to locate an enemy. I am baffled. I should have thought a warrior's prime goal to be the elimination of all other warriors.
No. A warrior's prime goal is to overcome other warriors. I am the greatest warrior our race has ever raised up. I have not worked in over 5,000 years. There is no one to overcome.
Oh.
Do you know what the R-brain is?
Wait. It's coming. Oh, I know what the R-brain was, the primitive reptile brain from which the human brain evolved.
And do you know that for a considerable time, early humans, true humans, possessed beneath their sentient brains a vestigial but powerful R-complex called the subconscious mind?
Of course, the first great antinomy.
I have an R-complex.
I registered shock. You cannot possibly be old enough. I could sense his bitter grin before the sight of it crawled to me at light speed.
Do you notice anything interesting about this particular star system?
I glanced around. Barring your presence in it, no.
Consider that planet there. The third.
At first glance, it was an utterly ordinary planet, like a myriad of others in this out-of-the-way sector. It was wet, and therefore alive, and even showed signs that it had evolved intelligent life at least once, but of course that was, by definition, long gone. None of its remaining life forms seemed anywhere near bright enough to leave it behind and enter the world yet. Its physical and ballistic properties appeared unremarkable. But after only a few days of contemplation, I cried out in surprise. Why, its period of rotation is almost precisely one standard day, and its period of revolution seems to approximate a standard year, and its surface acceleration is a standard G. Do you mean to tell me that planet is dirt,
he agreed, and yonder star is Sol.
And you imply that...
Yes. I was born here, on that planet, in fact, at a time when all the humans in the universe lived within the confines of this system, and used less than half the planets at that. Do you still wonder that I shun your bonding?
No. To you, with a reptile brainstem, it must be the ultimate obscenity.
Defenselessness, yes.
A thing which can be neither dominated nor compelled, and which itself will not dominate or compel. You must hate us.
Aye.
You could be healed. The reptile part of your brain could...
I could be gelded, too, and why not, since none will breed with me? Yet I choose to retain my gonads and my R-complex. Call it habit.
I see. I paused and thought. What prevents you from physically attacking the bond? I believe that at this point in history, you could harm it greatly, perhaps even destroy it.
I repeat, what good is a fight you can't lose?
Oh.
In the old days, there was glory. There was a galaxy to be tamed, empires to be carved out of the sky, mighty enemies to challenge. More than once I pulverized a star. With four allies I battled the 10 of Algol, and after 2 centuries broke them. Then were other sentient races found in the inner neighboring arm of the galaxy, and I learned the ways of fighting them. He paused. I was honored in those days. I was one of mankind's saviors.
A terrible chuckle.
Do you know anything sorrier than an unemployed savior?
And your fellows?
One day it was all changed. The brain had evolved. Man's enemies were broken or co-opted. It became clear that competition for unlimited wealth is insane. Peace broke out. The cursed bonding began. At first we fought it as a plague swallowing our charges, but ere long we came to see that it was what they had freely chosen. Finally there came a day when we had only ourselves to fight.
And?
We fought.
Whole systems were laid to waste. Alliances were made and betrayed. Truly frightening energies were released. The rest of mankind withdrew from us and forgot us. I can see how this would be. Man had no need of us. Man was in harmony with himself and his neighbors, and it was now plain that in all the galaxy there were no threatening races, extant or imminent. For a long time we had hoped that there might lie enemies beyond this galaxy, that we might yet be needed, and so we fought mock combats, preserving ourselves for our race. We dreamed of once again battling to save our species from harm. We dreamed of vindication. A long pause. Then we heard of contact with bondings of sentient beings from neighboring galaxies. The unification began. In rage and despair we fell upon each other, and there was a mighty slaughter. There was one last false alarm of hope when the malign bonding of the Crab Nebula was found. His voice began to tremble with rage. We waited for your summons, and you... Suddenly he screamed. You cured the bastards! Listen to me, I said. A neuron is a wonderful thing, but when a billion neurons agree to work together, they become a thing a billion times more wonderful. A brain, a mind. There are as many stars in this galaxy as there are neurons in a single human mind. More than coincidence. This galaxy has become a single mind, the bonding. There are as many galaxies in this universe as there are stars in the average galaxy. Each has or is developing its own bonding. Each of these is to be a neuron in the cosmic mind. One day, unification will be complete, and the universe will be intelligent. You can be part of that mind and share in it.
No, he said emphatically. If I am part of the cosmic mind, then I am part of its primitive subconscious mind. The subconscious is useful only for preservation from outside threat. As your brain evolved beyond your ancestors' subconscious mind, your universal mind has evolved beyond me. There is nothing in the planum that you need fear.
He leaned forward in sudden pain, embraced his asteroid with his arms as well as his legs. I began moving closer to him, not so rapidly as to alarm him if he should look up, but not slowly.
When we understood this, he said, we warriors fell upon each other anew. 4 centuries ago, Jarl and I allied to defeat the one in red. That left only each other. We made it last, as long as we could. Perhaps it was the greatest battle ever fought. Jarl was very, very good. That was why I saved him for last.
And you overcame him?
Since then I have been alone.
He lifted his head quickly and roared at the universe.
Jarl, you son of a bitch, why didn't you kill me?
He put his face again to the rock. I could not tell if he had seen me approaching. And in all the years since, you have had no opponent.
I tried cloning myself once. Useless. No clone can have my experience and training. The environment which produced me no longer exists. What good is a fight you cannot lose?
I was coming ever closer. Why do you not suicide?
What good is a fight you cannot lose?
I was near now. Then all these years you have prayed for an enemy.
I...
His voice was despairing. Your prayer is answered. He stiffened. His head came up and he saw me. I represent the bonding of the crab, I said then. The cure was imperfect, and I did direct at him a laser. I was near, but he was quick, and his mirror shield deflected my bolt even before he could have had time to absorb my words. I followed the laser with other energies, and he dodged, deflected, or neutralized them as fast as they could be mounted. There was an instant's pause then, and I saw a grin begin slowly and spread across his face. Carnivore's warning. He flung his own weapons into space.
I am delivered, he cried.
And then he shifted his mass, throwing his planetoid into a spin. When it lay between us, I thought he had struck it with both feet, for suddenly it was rushing toward me. Of course I avoided it easily, but as it passed, he darted around from behind it where he had been hidden, and grappled with me physically. He hurled the rock not with his feet, but with a reaction drive. Then did I understand why he kept such an ancient body form, for it was admirably suited to single combat. I had more limbs, but weaker, and one by one my own weapons were torn from me and hurled into the void. Meanwhile, mental energies surged against each other from both sides, and space began to writhe around us. Mentally, I was stronger than he, for he had been long alone, and mental muscles can be exercised only on another mind. But his physical power was awesome, and his ferocity a thing incomprehensible to me. And now I see the end coming. Soon his terrible hands will reach my brain case and rip it asunder. When this occurs, my body will explode with great force, and we shall both die. He knows this, and in this instant of time before the end, I know what he is doing beneath this shield where I cannot probe. He is composing his last message for transmission to you, his people, his bonding. He is warning you of mortal danger. He is telling you where to find his hidden DNA samples, where to find the records he has made of everything he knows about combat, how to train his clones to be almost as good as he is, and he is feeling the satisfaction of vindication.
I could have told you, he is saying, ye who knew not my worth, who had forgotten me, yet will I save you.
This is my own last message to you, to the same people, to the same bonding. It worked. He believes me. I have accomplished what you asked of me. He has the hero's death he craved. We will die together, he and I. And that is meet and proper, for I am the last healer in the cosmos. And now I, too, am unemployed. That story appears in the collection User Friendly from Bain Books and is copyright 1998 by Spider Robinson, all rights reserved. Now here's Doug Cox, Salil Bhatt, and Ramkumar Mishra with the opening track of their amazing CD Slide to Freedom, Payday.
All I can do, you know I can't get along with you. I'm gonna take you to your mama. Payday, payday, payday. I'm gonna take you to your mama. Payday. There's a rabbit in that log, and I ain't got no rabbit. Get away, get away, get away. I should hate to see that rabbit get away. About a week ago, you know I stole a ham of meat. I'm gonna keep my skillet greasy if I can, if I can, if I can. I'm gonna keep my skillet greasy if I can. Sack on my back. I'm gonna make it to my shanty for a day, for a day, for a day. I'm gonna make it to my shanty for a day. Payday, payday. I'm gonna take you to your mama.
That was my friend Doug Cox playing God knows which one of his thousands of stringed instruments, and the great Salil Bhatt playing an instrument of his own invention, the Satvik Veena, backed by Ramkumar Mishra on tablas. The album Slide to Freedom features several more stunning tracks. There's one you can find at the website, www.dougcox.org, that's just amazing, called Meeting by the Liver. And there are also a couple of tracks on the album that feature Salil's father, Pandit Vishwa Mohan Bhatt, who won a Grammy for his work with Rai Cooter and has recorded other amazing albums with people like Bela Fleck. Now here's another one of my short stories from the same collection, User Friendly. This one's called Orphans of Eden. Well, what would you have done? Begin at the front part, Spider. It was just after 2 a.m. I was right here in my office, as we call the dining room in this family, about to write a science fiction story called Orphans of Eden on this loyal, senescent Macintosh, when he appeared in the doorway from the kitchen right next to my lava lamp. I don't mean came through the doorway and stopped. I mean he appeared in the doorway. He sort of shimmered into existence, like a Star Trek transportee or the ballplayers disappearing into the corn in Field of Dreams in reverse. He was my height and age, but of normal weight. His clothing was crazier than a basketball bat. I never did get the hang of the fashion assumptions behind it. I'd like to say the first thing I noticed about it was the ingenious method of fastening, but actually that was the second thing. First, I observed that his clothing pointedly avoided covering either genitals or armpits. I kind of liked that. If you lived in a nice world, why would you want to hide your smell? He stood with his hands slightly out from his sides, palms displayed, an expectant look on his extraordinarily beautiful face. He didn't look afraid of me, so I wasn't afraid of him. I hit Command S to save my changes, title and a handful of sentences, and forgot that story completely. Forever, now that I think about it. "When are you from?" I asked him. "Originally, I mean." I'm not going too fast for you, am I? If a guy materializes in front of you, and you're sober, well, he might be the genius who just invented the transporter beam, but if he's dressed funny, he's a time traveler, right? Gotta be. Thank God the kitchen door was open, had been my very first thought. He smiled, the kind of pleased but almost rueful smile you make when a friend comes through a practical joke better than you thought he would. "Very good," he told me. It was okay, but that's not a responsive answer. "I'm sorry," he said, "but I can't say I think a lot of the question itself. Still, if it really matters to you, I was born in the year 2146, though we didn't call it that at the time, naturally. Feel better now?" He was right. It hadn't been much of a question, just the only one I could come up with on the spur of the moment. But I thought it small of him to point it out. I mean, what a spur! What a moment! And the information was mildly interesting, if useless. "You don't go around pulling this on civilians, do you?" I asked irritably. "You could give somebody a trauma." "Oh, good Lord, no," he said. "Why, half the other science fiction writers alive now would lose sphincter control if I materialized in their workplace like this." It was some comfort to think that my work might survive at least another 155 years. Unless, of course, he had run across one of my books in the middle of next week. "That's because they think wonder is just another tool, like sex or violence or a sympathetic protagonist. Whereas you know it is a religion, a grail, the divine carrot that is the only thing that makes it possible for human beings to ever get anywhere without a stick across their ass, yes, it shows in your work. You understand that only by putting his faith in wonder can a man be a moral being. So you're not afraid of me or compelled to disbelieve in me, and you probably hadn't even gotten around to trying to figure out a way to exploit me until I just mentioned it. You're too busy wondering." I thought about it. "Well, I'm sorry to say I've been wasting a good deal of time and energy on trying not to look stupid in retrospect, but yes, most of my attention has been on wonder. Before we get to the question and answer section, though, what's your name?"
"Why?" he asked. "There's only one of me."
"Suppose I want to swear at you." He gave a smaller version of that faintly annoying smile. "Good point. My name is Daniel." My wife's ex-husband is named Daniel. Also amazing. Also faintly annoying at times. "Would you mind if I went and woke up my wife? She'd be sore if I let her sleep through this." Jeannie enjoys looking at very beautiful men. Obviously. Our teenager, on the other hand, would doubtless find a 200-year-old grown-up 5 times more boring than me. And enough music to wake her, the only thing that will do the trick, would probably also wake the tenants downstairs in the basement suite. "And would you care for some coffee?" He shuddered slightly, then saw my expression.
"Sorry. That was for the coffee, not your wife.
Imagine I brought you back to a Cro-Magnon's cave and he offered you refreshments. My turn to apologize. Sorry, I wasn't thinking. As to Jeannie, please don't misunderstand. I would be honored to meet her under other circumstances another time. Your collaborations with her are even better than your solo work. I nodded strong agreement. But if I correctly decipher her input therein, she is a Soto Zen Buddhist and a sentimentalist. What's wrong with that? I demanded. Nothing at all, but I seek advice on a practical matter of morality, and you understand how omelets are made. I frowned. Do you mind if the Cro-Magnon has a little cup of jaguar blood to help him think? This is your house, he said simply. Well, actually it isn't. I'm a writer, I rent, but I knew what he meant and agreed with it. I thought about that while I turned another cup of water into dark Tanzanian magic and spooned in sugar and whipped cream. By the time I tipped the old Bushmills into the coffee, my Irish was up. Before we start, I said. Yes? He was watching my preparations with the same gravity I'd like to think I could bring to watching an autopsy. You have managed to be sufficiently interesting that I will forgive you this once, I said, but if you ever again drop in without phoning ahead first like that, I'll set the cat on you. He did not quite look wildly around. Do you have a cat? I winced. Smokey was killed a month ago by some asshole motorist in a hurry, one of the best masters I ever served. I'll get one if necessary, and I don't want to hear any guff when you reach my answering machine either. It's always on. People should be grateful I let them leave messages. Understood and agreed, he said, and I apologize. But in my defense, what would you have done if I had left a phone message? I nodded. That's why I forgive you this once. I made one last try at hospitality. I can offer you charcoal-filtered water. Thank you, no. I pointed to a kitchen chair and took the one across the table from it for myself. He sat beautifully, like a dancer or one of Jeannie's Alexander Technique students. I took a long, appreciative sip of my Irish coffee. I'm listening, Daniel, I said. Before we start, yeah? When will you begin to get excited? About a minute after you leave, I hope. By then I can afford to. He nodded. We both knew I was lying, and the cup was trembling. He really was trying to be polite. Why was he trying so hard to be polite? You spoke of wanting my advice on a practical matter of morality, I went on. Is this an ends-justifying-means kind of deal? I had succeeded in impressing him. You have succeeded in impressing me, he said. Yes. I sighed. You've read Mind Killer. He nodded. It's one of my scarier books. One or two critics, after having had someone literate summarize it for them, have declared that it says the end justifies the means. Beginning for the first time to be a little scared myself, I said, "And have you got the secrets of Mind Wipe and Mind Right?" "Oh, no," he said, convincingly enough to make me relax again. "What's holding things up?" I asked. "I expected that stuff to come along well before 2040. "You vastly underestimate the complexity of modeling the brain." I nodded philosophically. "Yeah, it's going around these days." "Well, I'm relieved, I guess. I had to force that happy ending. That happens to me a lot in the serious books." He nodded again. "But you keep doing it. Splendid." "Thank you. The better the flattery, the warier I become. Back to business." "Then I am to assume that you have another moral dilemma as sharp as the one faced by Jacques in Mind Killer?" "It is to me. I want you to tell me if I am a monster, or simply a victim of my inability not to ask the next question." "Or both," I pointed out. "Or both," he agreed. I took another long gulp of Irish coffee. I've long since worked out to my own satisfaction the one about a writer's responsibility, but I'd always known that book would come back to haunt me one day. "Let me get this straight. You have already done whatever this thing is. Some would call it monstrous, and now you want my opinion on whether or not you were right to do it. Why, since it's too late?" "I need to know if I dare go public, in my own ficton, my own space-time. If I can't persuade you, I can't persuade anybody." "Well, I always had the sneaking idea I'd make a good judge, if only there weren't so damn many laws. Time to find out if I was right." "First tell me your ends, then your means, if you can do it that way." "Well, I can approach it that way," he said, "but the ends imply the means. I can put it in a nutshell. I wanted to do meaningful sociological experiments." I understood him at once because he was speaking to the heart of the science fiction story I'd intended to write. But in case I only thought I understood him, I dragged the exposition out of him like a good character should. "What do you mean?" I think you suspect, he said. Most of the really important questions about human societies are unanswerable because you can't contain the size of the question. You can't understand the ancient Romans if you don't know about all their neighbors and trading partners and subject peoples, and you can't really grasp any of them any better because they all influence each other helter-skelter, and you can't even get a start on any one of them until you know their whole history, back to their year one. It's the history that's even worse than the local complexity. So much of any society is vestigial, the original reasons for its fundamental assumptions forgotten. And it's the history that always gets in the way of trying to make things better. Look at your own contemporary phecton. Can you imagine any solution to the Irish problem, or the Serbo-Croatian problem, or the Palestinian-Jewish problem, or any one of 100 others like them, that does not involve giving everyone involved mass amnesia and erasing all the history books? Well, yes, I said, but it won't come soon, now that you tell me telepathy isn't even going to be as easy as time travel. For all I know, telepathy could come along before 2300, he said. I left in 2292. I calculated without much surprise that he was at least 144 subjective years old. And one of the limitations of time travel, a blessed one in my opinion, is that you cannot go further forward in time than you have already been. The only way to see the future is to live it. But I'm not expecting telepathy soon, then soon, either. I finished my coffee. I'm sorry to hear that. Still, there's no real hurry. Once we have telepathy and time travel, we can build heaven or a reasonable facsimile retroactively. As in your book, Time Pressure, he agreed. But since I don't expect that soon and can't depend on it ever, I'm trying to save the human race in a different way. There is some urgency about the matter. When I come from, we have come very close to destroying ourselves in catastrophic warfare. Nanotechnological? Worse. I strongly advise you to leave it at that. I could not suppress the shudder or the squirm that followed it. I had been wondering if he was too evolved to have immunities for primitive local germs. Just wondering, not worrying, as I believe a man's health is his business. Now I was reminded that there are circumstances under which a man's health is your business. Was Daniel carrying anything? Too late to worry now. What kind of a phecton is it you live in? He hesitated. It's hard to give you a meaningful answer. Imagine I'm a Cro-Magnon. Tell me, what's your world like? Giddy with fear and pride and guilt and shame, but trying to be as decent as it can. He nodded thoughtfully. Okay. In those terms, the 2290s are sullen, scared, and preoccupied with the present. In the immediate past is horror, and just beyond that are things that inexorably brought it on us, and still we prefer not to think over much of the future. We see what went wrong and don't know how to fix it. As near as we can see, all the future holds is another slow, painful climb to the pinnacle which blasts all who stand on it, and those of us who think about that wonder what's the point, so not many of us think about it. I was more grateful than ever to have lived my life in the 20th century, but I was also puzzled. It's hard to square that with your clothes. That kind of outfit in that kind of world doesn't ring true. People like that would cover up. He smiled sadly. These clothes were designed elsewhere. Skip irrelevancies. The night was old. Okay, so what do you figure to do about your situation? He clasped his fingers together before him on the table, with his spine so straight it made him look as if he were praying. It's all the history, you see. The weight of all that history, all the mistakes we can't ever undo or forget. I can understand that. Probably you can. The problem is just now beginning to become apparent. Time was when the maximum length of history was the number of stories an old man could tell before he died. Then we got too damn good at recording and preserving the stories. At about the same time, there began to be too many stories, and they all interacted. And then came the information explosion. Human beings are only built to tolerate the knowledge of so much failure and tragedy. All the things we've ever done to warp the human spirit, from making wars to making gods, are there in us, at the root of anything we plant, at the base of anything we build. When you try to start all over again from scratch, you find out you can't. Your definition of scratch merely defines the direction history has warped you in and condemns you to tug in the other direction. But the weave is too complex to straighten. It's too late for us to start over. It's too late to try to create a society without taboos. The people who would try it are warped by the knowledge of what a taboo is. It's too late to try and create a society without sexual repression. The parents inevitably pass along to their children these warped shadows of the repressions they inherited themselves. It's too late to make a society without racism, and so on. Every attempt at an experimental utopian community has failed, no matter how hard they try to keep themselves isolated from the surrounding world. Sealing yourself up in a self-sustaining space colony and smashing all your comm gear doesn't help. It's just too late to experiment with a society that has no possessions or conformity or tribalism or irrational religions. All possible experimental subjects are compromised by their knowledge of human history. What's needed is some way to put an undo key on history. I think I see where you're going, I said. I was just about to write a story about... I know, he interrupted, and you were going to screw it up. We'll never know, will we? Go on. Well, I think you know the only possible solution. Let's do a thought experiment. I know you won't mind the pun. Hypothetically, put a bunch of pre-verbal children, infants for preference, in a congenial artificial environment. Plenty of room, plenty of food for the taking, mild climate, no predators, an adequate supply of useful materials and appropriate technology for later. Immunize them against all disease and give them doctor robots that will see them into adulthood and then fall apart. Provide AI packages to teach language skills and basic hygiene, both carefully vetted to be as semantically value-free as possible. Have the AI design the language, I suggested. Yes, open-ended, but with just enough given vocabulary to sustain complicated thought. Let them invent their own, a clean foundation. When they're ready to handle it, have the machines teach them the basic principles of mathematics and science, using numbers rather than words wherever possible, and just enough philosophy to keep them from brewing up organized religion, and not a damned word of history. Then you go away and come back in 1,000 years. To find them knifing each other over which one has the right to sacrifice a peasant to the teaching machines, I said. You are not really that cynical. Of course I am. Why do you think I have to keep writing those happy endings? You know, another writer wrote a story years ago with the same basic theme as your thought experiment. Yes, he said. And what was the first thing his protagonist did? Saddled the poor little bastards with the author's own religion, gifted them with shame and sin and an angry but bribable paternalistic god and a lot of other moral mumbo-jumbo fooey. He had greatness in his hands and he blew it. That time. I didn't quite agree, but the differences were quibbles, and I had something else to think about. This wasn't a science fiction story Daniel was describing, or any cockamamie thought experiment. I once heard a black woman use some memorable language. She described someone as having been as ugly as death backing out of an outhouse reading Mad Magazine, ugly enough to make a freight train take a dirt road. All at once a thought uglier than that was slithering around under my hair. Talk about cynical, I went on. Why don't we get down to the crucial problem with this little thought experiment, as you call it? I was looking him in the eye, and he did not look away, but he didn't answer me either. So I did. The problem is, where do you get the infants? Yes, he said slowly, that was the problem. I poured more Irish coffee, omitting coffee, cream, and sugar. When it was gone, I said, "So you're the guy that laid the bad rap on all those gypsies." I was trying hard not to hate him. I try not to hate anybody, no matter how much it seems indicated, until I've walked around it a little while. And he hadn't said he was through talking yet, but so far I really hated this. He looked confused for the first time since I'd met him. Then he got my reference. No, no, that wasn't me any more than it was gypsies. As far as I know, that child-stealing gossip was sheer wishful thinking on the part of parents, combined with a natural hatred of anybody who didn't have to stay in the village they were born in. I've never stolen a baby anywhere in time. Then where did you get them? Roll your own? In a test tube or a petri dish or whatever? Were the donors informed volunteers? Even if the answer was yes, I didn't like this one any better. Call up human beings out of nothingness to be born or decanted or whatever, and suffer and die for purely scientific reasons? At least the first generation of them compelled to grow up without parents or role models, forced to reinvent love and law and humor and a trillion other things I took for granted? If they could, grow babies as guinea pigs? I've never made a baby either, he said. Not even with someone else's genes. I frowned.
Then I give up, Mr. Bones. How did that time traveler?
Oh. Then I said, oh. And finally, oh. lot of infants have been abandoned on a lot of windy hillsides or left in dumpsters since time began, he said sadly. If Pharaoh's daughter had happened to miss Moses, she probably could have picked up another one the next day. It tends to happen most in places and times where, even if the child had somehow miraculously been found and taken in by some contemporary, it would have had a maximum life expectancy of about 30 years. So I denied some of them the comfort of a nice quick death by exposure or predator, brought them to a safe place, and gave them the means to live in good health for hundreds of years. And use them as guinea pigs, I said, but without any real heat in it. I was beginning to see his logic. He didn't duck it. That's right. Now you tell me, are my actions forgivable? Give me a minute, I said, and poured more whiskey in thought. Thou shalt not use human beings as guinea pigs. Don't be silly, Spider. Accept that and you've just tossed out most of medicine. Certainly all the vaccines. First you use guinea pigs, sure, but sooner or later you have to try it on a human or you're just a veterinarian, and meanwhile people are dying in pain. Well, thou shalt not experiment on human beings without their informed consent. Many valuable psych experiments collapse with informed consent. You can't experiment with the brain chemistry of a schizophrenic without endangering his life. You can't find out whether slapping a hysteric will calm him down by asking him. You have to try it and see what happens. Daniels, too, is an experiment which by definition may not have informed consent. Informing the subject destroys the experiment. Is there written anywhere some fundamental law forbidding a man to withhold information even if he believes it to be potentially harmful? Thou shalt not use infants as guinea pigs. Hogwash, for the same reasons as number one above. How do you test an infant mortality preventative if not on an infant? Should we not have learned how to do fetal heart surgery? Do not the benefits of amniocentesis outweigh the, please God, few who will inevitably be accidentally skewered? Would Daniel's orphans really be better off dead than in Eden? Thou shalt not play God. Well, God knows someone has to, especially if the future is as grim as Daniel says, and she hasn't been answering her phone lately. When it comes down to the crunch, humans have always tried to play God if they thought they could pull it off. Ah. There was the crux. "And what kind of results have you gotten?" I asked. His face split in a broad grin. "Ah, there's the crux, isn't it? If you examine the data that came out of the Nazi death camps and profit from that terrible knowledge, are you any better than Dr. Mengele?" I winced. "That is the question I want you to answer," he said. "You are completely insulated from any possible backlash to your answer. The people who will ultimately judge me will never know you were consulted even after the fact. There is no stick to be applied to you as a result of your answer, and now I will offer the carrot, the same carrot that got me into this." I was already reaching for the whiskey. Damn it, I thought, this isn't fair. All I ever tried to do was entertain people. "Balls," came the answer from deep inside. "If you tell me that constructing the experiment was a moral act," he went on inexorably, "I will tell you everything I can about the results." "Well, what would you have done?" Some of my dreams of the future are more optimistic than others. That was Orphans of Eden, copyright 1998, by Spider Robinson, all rights reserved. Janice Ian is the Energizer folk singer, a gifted composer, singer, guitarist who has not stopped writing brilliant songs since she had her first planetary smash hit in 1965 with Society's Child, now in the Grammy Hall of Fame. 10 years later, she touched even more hearts and minds forever with the classic Grammy-winning song, At 17. Shortly after that, America, in its musical wisdom, turned away from acoustic music with meaningful lyrics to explore the subtleties of disco and a number of subsequent blind alleys, but Janice just never stopped. She has an unbroken string of brilliant albums unmatched by any other songwriter I can think of, 33 of them according to Wikipedia. Check her out at www.janiceian.com. Here she is now, kicking ass and taking names in a track from her glorious new CD, Folk is the New Black. Here's Danger. Danger.
He got my rainy talking about a jelly roll. Chuck Berry working on a mojo. Bessie Smith singing Bulldagger Blues. Elvis twitching on the evening news. Danger, danger, can't you see? That sex should stay in mystery. So ban that music, yes sirree. That's what America means to me. Jean Cocteau, all the queers will have to go. Mr. Tennessee Williams, Plato too. You gotta give J. Edgar Hoover his due. Danger, danger, can't you see? They're in your local library. So ban those authors, yes sirree. That's what America means to me. The wops and the kites. Gonna ban all the chinks and the towelhead types. Ban all the wetbacks, ban all the fags. Wrap it up tight in the American flag. Danger, danger, can't you see? It's dangerous when they are free. So ban those lazy refugees. That's what America means to me. That's obscene. It ought to be a felony to practice such stupidity. But it's my right, as you can see. That's what America means to me.
Seem to have accidentally come back to much the same theme addressed in our first selection by Todd Butler. Let's cool ourselves a little while on the way out. I live in a place called Bowen Island, British Columbia. Among its innumerable virtues, it is just crawling with world-class musicians and singers and songwriters. Honest to God, pull out a guitar anywhere on this rock, and within 5 minutes you'll have a bass player and a cello jamming with you very well. The Bowen Island Arts Council has sponsored concerts and workshops out here by artists like Amos Garrett Acoustic Trio and Doug Cox, many others, and it produced a simply stunning CD called Bowen Eclectic for a fundraiser, a sampler of the truly startling breadth and depth of talent to be found on this minuscule island 20 minutes west of the continent. Now here's my problem. I got 17 tracks, and there ain't a single dud, swear to God. And the artists include people like Christy Grace, Pauline LaBelle, Julie Vick, Sherry Ulrich, and me. And the rest are all friends and neighbors of mine. So how do I pick a track to play you? Self-interest. Rob Bailey is owner-operator of the Treehouse Studio here on Bowen, where I've recorded all my audio books so far and Rocket Ship Galileo for Blackstone Audio, all of which are available at www.blackstoneaudio.com. It's in large part thanks to Rob I was a finalist for the Audi Award last year and won the Earphones Award this year. So here's some payback. A heartbreakingly beautiful instrumental by Rob Bailey and Stan Gazziola, Blues for Ken.
3, 4... Thank you.
lot more information about Bowen Eclectic is available at the website of the Bowen Island Arts Council at www.biac.ca. If you're willing to take my word for it, that all 17 tracks on that album are as good as that one in almost a dozen different genres, you can order the sucker for yourself by emailing admin@biac.ca. Okay, that's Spider on the Web number 32, and I'm still Spider Robinson, the singing science fiction writer. Thanks for falling by. Bless your hearts, spleens, and at least a kidney apiece for your subscriptions and or donations, not to mention your deeply warming emails. If the sheriff don't get us, I'll be back next Friday with more of the usual Randy Gazoo. Till then, keep your powder up and your pecker dry. I'm off to make someone chuckle, a custom I recommend.